I thought I would never be able to work again. I was like, I just thought it's like having a puppy, but better. I was like, I'm never going to be able to leave and sit down and focus on anything else for the rest of my life.
Welcome to The Art of Fatherhood, a podcast that takes you on the journey of fatherhood. Now here's your host, Art Eddy.
What's going on, everybody? Art Eddy here for another edition of the Art of Fatherhood podcast. I'm very happy to have Greg Hurwitz. Thanks for taking the time to chat with me. Greg, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing well, man. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to chatting with you about a whole bunch of great things, especially your sci-fi series, new thing. We're going to talk about Orphan X and talk about comic books, but like bringing good guys like yourself on to talk about their fatherhood journey. When you found out you were going to be a dad, what was going through your mind, sir?
I thought I would never be able to work again. I was like, I just thought it's like having a puppy, but better. I was like, I'm never going to be able to leave and sit down and focus on anything else for the rest of my life. That was basically my sentiment. It's over. Somehow I'll have to make money to keep feeding this creature. But aside from that, like, nothing else is of interest.
Hands down, one of the best answers, Greg. Not going to lie to you. That I love that. Fantastic. People know your work. You know, creativity is probably something you try to pass on to your kids. But before I put even more words in your mouth, talk a little about some of the values and things you were looking to instill into them.
Wow, instilling my kid. I mean, honesty, number one, first and foremost. Number two, take risks, right? You know, that's when they're playing, whether it's sports or for fun, you know, push things to the limit. It's okay to get injured. It's okay to fail. It's okay to pick up. It's okay to figure out where the boundaries are. That's a big part of it. You know, trying to encourage honesty with themselves, right? And with their other interactions. And the most important thing is that they're funny, because I feel like humor is the highest form of EQ in a lot of ways. And, you know, both of my daughters are really, really funny. They're really funny. And that was a big value. And that's a value for me too. It's funny because for them, it's a lot of their friends and the circles they move in tend to be people who are also really funny. And I think there's a lot of wisdom and humor. There's a lot of ways to backdoor information. There's a lot of ways you can communicate in and around it. And it's a very important value set. And so that was a big thing we inculcated in them, and which I think they came by naturally from their own little, you know, twisted ladders of their DNA.
Nice. No, but I think you're spot on with like humor, because there is like a combination of street smarts and book smarts, because you got to know when to pick and choose a certain, I mean, yes, people can be the class clown, but they're like the real funny ones, I think, have the best timing, know what to say, like know what type of joke to, like they know their audience, right?
That's right. That's right. And you know, it helps you undercut yourself. It helps you undercut other people when they're getting too serious. It helps undercut if you're getting too street or too cerebral, right? So it's a good balancing trait, which is why I like it.
Nice. Love it, man. Talk a little bit about something that your daughters have taught you, either about yourself or about life, that maybe you didn't know was there until you had kids, or maybe you thought about it, but like once, you know, kids came into the forefront, they taught you a value about life or about yourself you'd like to share.
Look, the biggest thing for me that happens when I had kids is like, there's this realization that no matter what, your needs have to come second, like period. And that's a pretty big awakening, you know, when you become a parent, it's like, it's concrete. And it took, there's a kind of responsibility that's on your shoulders that no matter what, that's gotta be the top priority. Doesn't mean you do it right all the time. It doesn't mean you don't make mistakes. Doesn't mean you screw it up. But in the kind of dominant hierarchy of the values by which you run your life, they're forever interrupted, right? And in that embrace of that, right, in the embrace of that responsibility, there's a lot of meaning in the world that's different kind of meaning. And some of it's hard. Like we get hung up, especially in America, which is land of like the prolonged adolescence in a lot of ways. We get hung up on what we're giving up or what we're missing. But so much of it is when shouldering that, which can be complicated at times, you know, especially if you're parents when you're younger, or, you know, depending on where you are and how you've arrived at it. But there's so much to be learned and figured out in that can be fortifying and strengthening and can kind of prepare you for what your what one's other ventures are. You can learn so much about yourself.
Yeah, no doubt. Thank you very much for sharing that. And I think some of the things we were already saying, maybe they could use as parenting advice or a dad hack, but you want to share with new dads, maybe a piece of advice or a dad hack?
New piece of advice for a dad hack. Whether with your wife or your partner, however your family's made up, like one of the things that's really important is that you try to remember, it's very similar. It's funny because lately I've been thinking a lot about how so many of the conversations or fields that I play in, I do, you know, whether it's comics, film, TV, novels, whether it's stuff that you're working on in parenting, whether it's engaging in the culture or politics, a lot of things are the same thing. And so there's a thing that I always talk about when you get notes on a screenplay in Hollywood, where they give you a note and often they'll say, oh, this the script is really slowed down here. It's really boring in the third act. So you can dismiss that if it seems wrong or if it seems foolish. But our job is to identify the editorial anxiety that is underlying that. And so sometimes if you go, look, I'm going to take that seriously. But the thing is that's not where the script is broken. It just slowed down there. That's just where they realized that it was boring and they wrote it down. Really, there's problems in the second act, right? And so it's easy to dismiss it on the basis. And there's a similar thing, I think, when we're talking about advice for new dads, when they're dealing with their partner, you know, or the wife, is to say, okay, if there's a concern that's raised, instead of trying to tangle up on the content of the concern, which can be right or wrong, the more you can be open to trying to engage to figure out what is the underlying, you know, child rearing or emotional anxiety or concern. And if you can try and get to that piece, then you can kind of address that openly. Yeah. And, you know, I think having a kid is one of those things that puts a lot of pressure on all the systems, right? Because all of a sudden it's like families are resource-based, time and focus. And so it puts a lot of pressure. And so some of the parts where we would be inclined to misread things or have a filter that's out of whack, you know, are going to be pushed to the surface with exhaustion, with another little person who's screaming and feeding and, right, like it's this mess and who takes the bulk of your loving attention. And so I think it's really important when those things happen that you try and keep those lanes open and be open to trying to really figure out what's the solution, trying to really figure out and articulate as a family, what are the needs that need to be met and how can you meet them rather than getting hung up in arguments on the surface.
Great piece of advice right there. Thanks, Greg. People, make sure you take that. And even like, it's not your new parent, like even though you could be like a veteran parent, take that that advice to heart, because I appreciate that.
I'm still figuring that out. There's no mastering of that skill, you know? It's just one of the North Stars by which we imperfectly navigate our domestic lives.
No doubt. Congrats on the new sci-fi series, New Thing.
Thank you.
Talk a little bit about the series and what fans can expect from it, man.
I'm so excited for the series. I'm more excited for this series than anything else I've written in comics by a mile. I mean, one of the things that I wanted to do is write an anthology comic series where basically like the world has gotten so insane at this point, and it's gotten so beyond our expectations. If you go back to, like, for me, let's say you go back 20 years and change to college. If somebody was like, well, what's the culture like? What political conversations do you think you're having, right? Like, are the bad guys people want to get rid of Social Security? Or are the bad guys like people who want to put more resources here? Like, however the parties viewed each other, we never would think that we're here. We'd never think that we're here with technology. And so one of the notions that I had was to figure out a way to write about the present day as if it was science fiction, because it's so surreal that it's sort of like, and so the first book in the anthology is called The Screens, S-K-R-E-E-N-S. And it's about our reliance on these things and on these things that we're talking on. And I frame the whole thing as a sort of invasion from outer space. If we think about our reliance on our worship, our attention, our focus, and how it goes into screens instead of to ourselves and our lives. And so that was an example of taking something that's all around us, which is this technology that we're struggling to keep up with, that's literally rewiring our nervous systems, that's rewiring our relationships, our engagement in the world, what's real and isn't, and write about it from a full science fiction perspective with totally different language as if observing it anthropologically. And so it's this funny thing that's, I wanted to, you know, science fiction is one of the most amazing ways narratively to draw attention to the things that aren't safe to talk about, right? Whether it's 1984, whether it, I mean, go down the list. It's all of it. It's all of it. And I thought it would be such an interesting thing if I could write five stories that talk about where we are right now from perspectives that make people reflect differently. The second book in the anthology is a fairy tale that focuses around a culture that's increasingly, you know, punishment bent, where people, if you don't agree with their opinions, try to inflict maximum reputational and financial damage on people rather than being aware we all live in glass houses. And so it's a fairy tale where the glass house metaphor becomes, you know, somewhat real or somewhat overt. And that's what these stories are going to kind of examine. I'm super excited. I hope it finds resonance with readers. You know, I hope it finds its way to an audience. It's an unusual approach to storytelling, but some of the early reaction has been really strong. I just hope we can get it in the hands of more readers who want to, you know, kind of twist their brains in different ways.
Greg, like for me, that's amazing. Just the way you're kind of like, you know, we're going to talk about your creative process in a second, but I feel like the way you were kind of looking at things and what you were talking about in the beginning about, like, you know, especially our devices and how we're, you know, addicted to them. And like, it's almost like, I don't know why, but I thought of like Planet of the Apes, where, you know, the apes had us tied up and just were walking around and all that other stuff. Like, these devices have us tied up, right? Like, people aren't sleeping better. People are like, you know, I always tell my kids, like, you're not going to be on social media for a bit, just because, like, when I was in school, when I was your age, I had maybe 100 pair of eyes on me, right? Now you put something on social media, you have a million sets of eyes on you that you didn't even know existed and don't even care about you, but they're going to spit vitriol at you, right? So I love that concept.
Well, wait till we'll get you a lead copy of the third one in the anthology series, because it's right there in your wheelhouse, the argument you're having. So let's make sure we get you an advanced copy of that one. Okay.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate that. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we're going to like talk about, but Orphan X, man, talk a little bit about that, sir.
Well, Orphan X is my thriller series. I love, you know, book 7 was out. It's called Dark Horse. The first one's called Orphan X. It's the titular series. And look, it's sort of my homage to all the great archetypal characters that I grew up and love, whether it's James Bond, Jason Bourne, Jack Reacher. And I want to have a character, you know, so Evan Smoke is my lead. He's taken out of a foster home at the age of 12. He's trained to be an assassin, an off the books assassin. You know, he's one of the leading operators in the world. He's feared everywhere. No one knows where he is. And at a certain point, his father figure raised him. There's a key line for me around which the series coalesces, that his father figure and handler says to him, the hard part won't be making you a killer. The hard part is keeping you human. But he kept him human. And so where my series begins is at a certain point, he's gone off the radar. There's like a background, like, you know, there's mythology stuff where what's happened in his past is the orphan program coming after him. But he lives among ordinary people. And that pilot light in him of his humanity, he kept intact. And essentially, he's a pro bono assassin. People can call a 1-855 number. It's 1-855, the numeral 2, nowhere. And if people call that, you'll get an answer if you're in America. And they call him when they're desperate at the end of the rope with nowhere to turn. And he will engage where nobody else can, when nobody else can help. And he's basically a pro bono assassin for people in desperate need. And I've toggled that between this process because he was raised outside of normal society. I say he never learned the strange language of intimacy. He's like, was raised to be a machine, but he's living among ordinary people and he's interacting with them. And so there's this fun that I have with it where he'll go get in a knife fight and he's like bleeding through his sweatshirt. He'll tie it up in the car. He lives in a penthouse suite among people. He's kind of hidden in plain sight and he enters the building and all of a sudden he'll get dragged into like an HOA meeting where everybody's arguing about like the size of the carpet pile in the lobby. And he's like bleeding through his arm. Everyone's asking questions, right? Everybody's like really concerned about some issue of safety with the fact that the stairs aren't up to regulation. And so it's this constant toggling between the archetypal and the real world where we live. Because when I was reading as a kid, like you never get to see James Bond go home. You don't see Jason Bourne have like an awkward encounter with a single mom by the mail slots, right? Or get berated by the, you know, like irritable Jewish grandmother who lives upstairs from him, right? So there's all these ways to cross-pollinate this incredible badassery as he's seeking to find meaning and to protect what's good in the world and reorient his training and then living where we all have to live and function how we all have to function.
I freaking love that. Just the idea of like James Bond come like, all his white coat, his tuxedo is all like messed up, and he's like, "Hey, we need to talk about there's no watering on Wednesdays because we gotta let that just be that'd be
He's pulled in all the time of like, like there's a new beverage initiative for the lobby and should we have kombucha? And he's in this conversation and there's like death threats just pinging into his phone, right? And he's gotta go. So it's fun to have all that tension, but look, he's also imperfectly navigating relationships, community, how to be human and how to understand himself, which of course we're all navigating and figuring out.
Yeah, man. Love it. You're a creative person, obviously. How is it tough for you to like shut off your creative brain? Like, are you like, I know that especially you got to have your own discipline, right? Especially in your field. Like you got to make sure that there's time for you, time for your family. And then like, obviously work time, when it's time to work, this is a deadline, go. But like, if you're watching something or if you're just thinking about something, you're going for a walk and like, just something like you see something, and you're like experiencing like, oh, like maybe I could write that. Like, is it tough to shut off your creative brain?
Yes. Yeah. Or just my brain in general. And a lot of people have it. I mean, my brain happens to be creative, but a lot of people have that, my brain, there's a lot. I can get revved up. I work all day. It's hard to stop working. When I'm at a certain point in a project, whether it's a comic or a script or a novel, particularly the back like third of a novel, it's harder for me to not be writing than to be writing. Not always at the beginning anymore. There's a lot of like office cleaning and working out and like other stuff that, but like once I'm into something, it's very hard to try to unplug and be polite and civil and human and appropriate. It's like, it's very, but it's not an excuse to, behave preciously any more than if I had any other job. It's like, you still got to show up and try and be there. And, but sometimes I'll work longer and harder and have to leave and type notes. And it's hard to get out of, when my brain's feeling really active, as it is, I think, for a lot of people in a lot of fields.
My favorite character of all in the comic books is Wolverine. Definitely gravitated to him when I was like seventh, eighth grade. And I know you've written for him, you've written for Punisher, Moon Knight. It's really cool to see Moon Knight on, come have a live action thing. And I think Oscar Isaac did a great job. But for you, how do you kind of add your persona to characters that people already know? But one of the things I love about comics, whether it's your take on Wolverine or let's just say Jim Lee or whatever the case may be, right? Like you guys keep to that character, keep to the traits, but like there's certain qualities. If if you're up on the comic books, you see like, oh, this is, this is Greg's personality of Wolverine in there. Right. So how do you have fun balancing, like keeping it to the Marvel, like not just, maybe we'll just keep it to Marvel, but like keeping it to that character, but also adding your spin on that beloved character?
No, look, that's a great question. I mean, my dad was reading Batman before I was born, right? Like Batman will be around long after I'm dead. So these characters are a public trust. Of course, Marvel and DC will be quick to remind us that the IP belongs to them, and fair enough, right? They put a lot of investment into it, but they're in a public trust in a different way. When I'm writing my own character, he can do whatever I want. And we know what the parameters are. Like I can't have Spider-Man kill a busload of nuns, right? Like there are certain parameters that you can't go beyond, clearly.
Yeah.
But within that, part of it is when I get hired for something, I'm not trying to just write continued episodes or continued run. I'm also trying to think something that I can bring that's my voice into it while being super respectful. Super respectful. I sound like, being, intentionally respectful, I should say, of people's opinions, of fans, of kids, of adults, of, comic book geeks like us who, are like of everybody. But at the same time, I want to also have something to say. And so it's very interesting how that toggle is. And what I do is I tend to, when I got a job, like when I got Moon Knight to reboot Moon Knight, I did a similar thing with DC with New 52. We can talk about that in a minute. But I read every Moon Knight that I could get my hands on. I got the two big omnibuses of the original files. I read all of the key, I read everything, like literally all of it. I went in, give me all your Moon Knight, right? When I was rewriting villains for New 52 and recreating them on my Dark Knight run, I read every significant Penguin comic before I wrote my limited, which is called Pain and Prejudice. And then I figure out what I can do that's a little bit further or a little bit more, or that is my spin, or that updates and amends it in a way. So it's like you have to master the form before you can go beyond it. You know, and it I'm sorry, you have to be aware of those who have mastered it. I'm not going to ever claim I've mastered any creative form. But
I know what you meant. Yeah.
And so, you know, it's interesting, like if you think about like Picasso or Lichtenstein, who I love, who you probably love too, because all the comics that are in there, they were incredible realist painters. Like it's not like Picasso just all of a sudden came up with, you know, not just cubism, but like the crazy sketches that he does. Like he'd mastered it. And Lichtenstein was incredible with his art. And so in a lot of ways, it's like you better understand that anchoring before you improvise, right? You better learn the basics of jazz before you just improvise. And so for me, that's sort of the combination of that tightrope where it comes in. And I'll tell you, when I was doing Batman, I had a couple scenes that turned out to be like fan favorite moments. Like there's one scene where Batman shows up in Commissioner Gordon's office, and they're talking and they're at the window and Gordon's looking out and it's all dark. And he goes, "Oh, wait a minute. Like this is the part now where I turn around and you're not there anymore, right?" He's alone in the frame. And then a little word bubble comes from off and goes, "Nope, I'm still here." And then they turn around and they look at each other really awkwardly. And then they're like,
"Yes,
all right then." And then they both walk like opposite ways. And so there's ways that I could play with tropes like that, which is like, it's a hat tip to that wonderful convention that we love and that, which I've used, but it's also having all the readers in on that, right? But it's adding a different kind of wrinkle. And I love doing that stuff where it can be not like overly clever and meta, that I'm smarter than the convention, because I love that convention. I love Batman. I love it for real, you know, but ways that we can play with it in a way that shows a lot of passion and respect for it that readers come along for.
Greg, like when I read that part, I know exactly what you're talking about. You know? It's in my stack somewhere here, but like, I actually legit laughed out loud and everyone's like, "What?" I'm like, "It's going to take too long to explain." But
Yeah. It's inside joke. I mean, and look, the other thing I'll say is that you write the thing that you have to write. And so when I left Marvel for DC, I was dealt very generously by both Marvel and DC, which was great. And DC offered me a range of choices. And I was like, "I want to write the origin story for Penguin." And they were like, "Are you insane? Like, have you seen everything that we have, like all the characters, all the catalog, and that's what you want to do?" But to my mind, Penguin was so interesting because he's the only one in the rogues gallery who is sane, right? Riddler's insane, Joker's insane, right? You go down the list. And I also thought from his perspective, if you write from his perspective, then Batman's a bully, right? Like everyone else, he's been bullied, right? He's tall, he's handsome, he's got a great chin line. And I just wanted to write it. And everyone thought I was crazy. And to their credit, to their immense credit and my gratitude, they let me do it. I got an amazing artist. And I still remember the new 52 was going and they did an online survey. It's one of my favorite online surveys. They said, "Which series are you looking forward to the most?" And there was like 10 of them. And mine got like 0.0019% of the vote. And my favorite all-time anonymous comment was somebody wrote, "I'm really glad Hurwitz's mom voted for him." And it was like, it's one of these things where like nobody wanted a Penguin origin story, but I saw it, right? And I could have tried to get right away to Batman, you know, like go down the list, right? Green Lantern, Flash, right? We know who they are. But I wrote the thing I wanted to write and the critics came along for it. And then the readers came along for it. And it was this great lesson. And then at that point they said, you know, "Do you want to do a Batman book?" And because I'm a novelist and screenwriter, I was like, "Look, I don't have time to do it. The only way I would ever do an ongoing book is if it was Batman and if David Finch was the artist," because Finch was my favorite artist. And they said, "Look, Finch has a book called Batman the Dark Knight. He's wrote and illustrated the first one and he wants a writer, he'll illustrate it." And I was like, great. And I went from there on an amazing run. And so leading with passion, not with the most commercial notion, often will land you in the right place more than trying to sort of chase box office or sales or the highest profile stuff. And that was another important lesson that I learned.
Love it. I'm glad you mentioned box office because this question is going to be kind of loaded, but you know, you mentioned two people just like clamoring, like obviously social media. And like, I can only imagine like when they announce something, like I'll admit, like when Heath Ledger was, you know, the news got out that he was going to be Joker. I'm like, "What are you talking about? Like this guy's going to be Joker." I'm like, "Okay, whatever." And he's like, he blew my mind, like, to this day. Unfortunately, that role killed him, right? But like that, like, I don't see, besides Mark Hamill voicing the Joker and, you know, for the comic, I mean, the animated series and the video games, like, felt like Heath Ledger was the epitome. But I appreciate all different versions of Joker. Where I'm going with this is, like, especially now with all the age of blockbuster movies, and I know that, like, when I was a kid growing up, you had, like, maybe some of the other ones, like Spider-Man, Tobey Maguire, and all that other stuff, but now we are getting inundated with not just movies, but series and all these other things, like live-action series and animated, and some people are, like, taking things for granted, right? Or, like, just being like, I don't know if we want to have this series about the Penguin, but where it comes from, like you said, like, do you feel like comic book fans are at the point where we're getting too, like, our heads are getting big than they should have, just because we should appreciate all the different avenues a character can go down. And I just feel like everyone's like, no, it should be like this. And I know, like, Star Wars is kind of added in there with the sequels. They say stink and all that other stuff. Long and the short of it, like, do you think that sometimes geeks have it too good right now and we should just enjoy all the stuff that's coming out?
I think that's a very valid point. And look, the way that we've broken up and share and partake in entertainment has changed massively. And so on the one hand, I think the fans have a fair point, which is a lot of these franchises that we love are massively monetized, right? Like, they're money-making machines. And I feel like there's too much stuff to keep up with. And part of that is I feel like that makes it less special. And that's something that a lot of, like, if you're a fan geek boys, you know, they tend to be in a bit of an older age range. Like, I remember waiting online for 2.5 hours to get into Tim Burton's Batman, right? Like, it's an event. We all saw it at the same time, yeah. Right? It's like appointment viewing on TV. The last time we really had that was Game of Thrones, I feel like.
Yeah.
Everyone was waiting, and then it came out, and then everyone was talking about it. And so as the sense of community fragments based on the timing and scope and ways we take in information and the time frame of availability, we're losing a bit of a shared community. And I think that some people are looking, and I'm not just targeting comics, I'm talking about everything. It's true of Star Wars. It's true of, you know, if you look at movies, a lot of things are franchise based, right? Or world based, or, and it's a lot. And there is part of it for me that makes it feel a little bit less special than waiting forever for the new Star Wars to come out, right? And you had to see it in the theater, and then you had to see it again in a theater. And so I think there's some irritation about the way, some understandable irritation or sense of loss or even grief about the ways that these things that are special to us and emblematic of our childhood feel and are consumed differently now. And maybe that's coming out by being more like graspy and meticulous. And the other thing is where I think your point is fair, that everyone's got a bullhorn, everyone's got an opinion on social media. Everyone can rally up a mob and go, like, target someone or something. And, you know, it's a lot of people think that that should just be spoken about on every front, whether it's politics, culture, comics, like, whatever it is, that we all have to have an opinion about everything. And that's pretty insanity inducing. Like, I can't imagine if I was in seventh grade or sophomore in high school and people came up and were like, what do you think about Ukraine? Like, what's your belief about where things are right now with both political parties, right? Like, which candidates, what are your opinions about race and gender? What are your opinions about, like, what Star Wars is doing with this and casting and shit? There's so many things that people have access to and want to have sort of responsible, considered opinions about, but it's an inundation. And then sometimes that inundation feels like it's pure, that people are have genuine concerns and feelings. And sometimes it's being appropriated and corrupted in some ways for power games that people feel like bullied or targeted. And it's very hard to differentiate when they are, because we're sort of sorting out this new mess of having seemingly democratized our voices online. But in reality, you know, there's a lot of bots out there. There's a lot of people steering a conversation in ways that don't have a lot to do with it being purely democratic. And so it's very complicated public marketplace for people to engage in. So I try and give people room and have understanding about why they might feel overwhelmed and irritable and anxious and confused and spun up. And, you know, there's a lot going on right now with people online. They deserve a bit of room, you know?
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. And I think your serious new thing is, like you said, the glass house one. I can't wait for that one. Just because, like, man, we're living in those times. And just, you know, while I was thinking about, you know, just you writing Batman, and from a comic book writer's perspective, and a lot of people said with the Pattinson version of Batman, Yeah, it's like, oh, like visually it was too dark and this or that. I'm like, I just felt it was ripped out of the comic. I mean, yes, all the Batman movies are ripped out of the comic books. I get it. But this one, like, I felt like he was the detective. He was all these things. And, like, I just felt like it was grimy. And, like, everyone's like, it's always raining. I'm like, it's always raining in Gotham. So shut up. But, like, I just thought it was good. And then people were just crapping on it just to crap on it, you know?
I was really surprised it was good. I didn't really understand Pattinson fully as an actor until this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I know with Twilight, it was kind of like younger heartthrobby. You know, I had certain hesitations, you know, just for with myself that I wasn't like vocalizing, but about like, is this guy really going to pull it off? And I thought it was extraordinary. I thought he did a great job.
Yeah. And the Penguin, I like you said, like now I'm going to look at the Penguin character a little bit differently about like how he even sees Batman as a bully, and there is some legitimacy to that, so.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, I had a lot of fun writing that. It was a blast.
Nice, man. Thanks again for your time. We're going to finish off with the Fatherhood Quick Five. Favorite family movie? Do you guys have one?
Jurassic Park, Indiana Jones, or Jaws.
Nice. Great three movies right there. Can't go wrong with any of them. Favorite family song, or was there a band you couldn't wait to introduce your daughters to?
My youngest daughter loves Beth Hart. I love Beth Hart. And so that's a little bit older. That wasn't like, but you know, she's extraordinary. And so I was listening to her a lot, and my youngest daughter got a real ear for her stuff. I think she's extraordinary.
Nice. Describe the perfect family vacation. Where would it be?
Oh man. Probably going to Kauai, going on kind of like inner tubes floating through the sugar plantations that cut through mountains, surf lessons, Mai Tais, pool, a lot of reading. You know, I like Kauai because it's a perfect blend between the relaxing beach vacation, and then it's a very active island. There's a lot to do there.
Very
You
cool.
know, yeah.
Nice. Favorite comic book hero and villain? Is it too hard to like narrow each one down?
Oh, it's the same one. It's the Punisher.
Nice. And lastly, top three words you hope your daughters would use to describe you as a dad. What would you want them to be?
Funny, protective, loving.
Awesome. Great three words right there. People, make sure you follow Greg on Twitter, Greg Hurwitz, and then also on Instagram at Greg Hurwitz Books. And check out his website, greghurwitz.net, for all the great things that he's doing. I appreciate your time. I'm a big fan of your work. Can't wait to check out everything that you're doing. And again, I wish you and your family continued success, sir.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. This is a good talk.
Thanks. Thanks for checking out this week's edition of the Art of Fatherhood podcast. Please rate, subscribe, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. And also go to artoffatherhood.net. You can have a chance to check out some great articles like the weekly Dad's Doing It Right column, the Collector of the Week, and many more. Plus, you have a chance to win some very cool prizes like video games, collectibles, all that good stuff. Go to artoffatherhood.net. And please make sure you rate, subscribe, and review wherever you listen to podcasts, because I'll greatly appreciate it to get the word out on the Art of Fatherhood podcast. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Art of Fatherhood podcast. Leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts and go to artoffatherhood.net.